The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes, we're on Amazon, we're on Stitcher, other podcast platforms under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. We both have websites. Barbara's, of course, is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. You can find our years of past interviews up there. More than, I don't know, there are thousands, thousands of interviews up there at this point. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, and lately some really gratifying and interesting philosophical conversations. I mean, at least they're gratifying and interesting to me. You know, events of late have pushed some of these conversations more into the philosophical realm than I felt like used to happen. So that's been really fun. And I think today will certainly be one of those days with Lionel Shriver, a guest who I have been meaning to have on the show for years and years. Lionel Shriver's fiction includes The Motion of the Body Through Space, The Mandibles, Property, the National Book Award finalist So Much for That, the New York Times bestseller The Post-Birthday World, and the 2003 international bestseller We Need to Talk About Kevin. Of course, that was made into a movie starring Tilda Swinton about a decade ago. She is a regular columnist for The Spectator in Great Britain and for Harper's Magazine in the U.S. Her latest out this month is Should We Stay or Should We Go, a timely and possibly prescient novel about a couple who in middle age made a suicide pact to take place on the wife's 80th birthday, which happens to occur at the end of March 2020. So you can reflect on that. The book is published in the U.S. by HarperCollins, and it will drive much of our chat today. Lionel, welcome.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, you have hit on one of my favorite topics of obsession, which is aging, mortality, and death. So I was all in on this novel, both as character exploration and kind of thought experiment. But before we dive into the book, I thought we might take a step back or, you know, maybe a step up and get kind of a bird's eye view across your work and the kind of connective tissue that binds these many novels together. Because by and large, much of it is in contemporaneous conversation with the world. And I was wondering if you could just kind of talk generally about the evolution of thinking of your, you know, across your work, if you've been driven by the same concerns all along these decades, or if the gravity has kind of shifted at all with time and age. Just, you know, love to hear kind of your global impressions after all of these many novels.
I think I probably started out with my first couple of books much more oriented toward the personal, you know, things like one's romantic life, family relations, and broadened out gradually to become more political. And I that sounds like a turnoff. I don't mean necessarily political and, you know, like Democrats versus Republicans or something. Nothing could be more tedious. But more oriented toward the larger world rather than the small subjective world. And that has been a profitable direction for me. It's full of pitfalls, of course, because when you contend with the rest of the world, you also enter into areas that people have very strong opinions, especially lately. And you can alienate part of your audience by being perceived to be taking a side that they disagree with. So this danger has ramped up in recent years, especially. Yeah. And of course, there's also the danger that you just write polemics and you abandon the whole purpose of fiction, which is much more imaginative and emotional and not very clean. You know, fiction is messy. Nevertheless, I have felt that I've got a lot out of taking on some of the big issues that have come at us while I've been alive. I've written about obesity, Northern Irish troubles, international demography of all things. One of my recent novels was about the near future economic collapse of the United States. And, you know, these are big topics. I find going at them through fiction much more interesting than nonfiction. I do a lot of nonfiction, and I think I do passable essays and comment pieces, but it is far more an engaging process to attack big issues through story and character.
You used a little while back the word profitable, and you just used the phrase engage. I think you just said engaging. And I'm wondering if you unpack the word profitable, I assume you're not meaning economically profitable, but you're meaning kind of emotionally, artistically.
Yes, exactly. Artistically engaged. Profitable.
Yeah, I think it's very true and interestingly, maybe paradoxical that the world of fiction has a much bigger, I think, ability to persuade an audience if you're, I mean, I know your goal isn't persuasion, but I do think it has the ability to put an audience member into an emotional seat and take them on a very personal, tangible, sort of, you know, immersive journey that would likely make them think about things in a new way than nonfiction ever could. I mean, nonfiction, you're going to attract the audience you're going to attract, and you're going to probably persuade the half that you already have in your pocket. So yeah, I think fiction is such an interesting way to engage in conversations, much more effective than nonfiction.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word conversation. I mean, that I use a lot of dialogue. And one of the advantages of fiction is that you can have more than one opinion in the novel, and they can both be persuasive in their way and yet completely contradictory. And that's the world we actually live in, is
right.
That people violently disagree. And I have always enjoyed capturing those disagreements on the page, and in so doing, also highlighting some of the inconsistencies on both sides, the irrationality on both sides, the deeper motivation for each argument, which, you know, you sometimes have to dig for. You know, it's possible to present a much more complex, interrelated, and often deeply contradictory intellectual universe as well as an emotional universe. And I'm very interested in the way that what people espouse, what they think, what they believe is so integrated with self-interest and what kind of family you grew up in. It's not tidy. We didn't just all sit ourselves down in a library and do our homework and come to a conclusion.
I used to struggle with the phrase, the personal is political, when I was, you know, 30 or 40 years younger, and no more. I now understand it. You're exactly right. Do you feel like, kind of in that regard, do you feel like the work chooses you, or do you feel like you choose the work? Meaning, do these issues kind of stick to you and you say, I just have to write about this, or do you seek them out?
Well, I'm a big newspaper reader. I spend a lot of time just trying to keep up with what's happening out there. I wouldn't be prescriptive about that. And I'm sometimes envious of other friends of mine who don't keep up at all, do not read any of the magazines I read, do not read a daily newspaper. They seem to know what's going on, and I'm not quite sure how, but they live in a slightly different universe than I do. And it sometimes seems seductive. I'd be really curious what it would be like if I took a year out and just shut myself off from nonfiction media. And I'm curious whether I would be a happier or a more miserable person. And I cannot answer that question.
Is that how you've always been? Or has it just amped up with political adrenaline over the last years? Or is this just how you've always engaged with the world?
When I was in my early 20s, I wasn't really interested in the world of news at all. I didn't read the New York Times, and I didn't watch television news. And yeah, how did I know what was going on? I don't know. And that's just not the world that I wanted to inhabit. I was much more involved in, you know, pure story, form, language. So it's not that this almost obsessive consumption of media is intrinsic to me. I wasn't like some precocious 8-year-old who was sitting there with, you know, my local paper and taking apart the comment pieces.
Writing op-eds, yeah.
Right. I think that moving to Northern Ireland was very politicizing for me. because to set a book during the Troubles in Belfast really entailed doing a lot of research. That was the first book that I did do a lot of homework for. And I ended up sticking around, and that was where I cut my teeth as a journalist. That's where I wrote some of my first journalism. It's where I became a radio comment person. So it brought what we call the real world much more to the forefront of my life. As for whether I pick topics or they pick me, well, I mean, obviously it's a bit of both. I have spheres of interest that I maintain. I mean, for example, my fourth novel, Game Control, is set in Kenya, and the protagonist is a mad demographer. I have kept up with demography ever since. It's a sideline. And that's been one of the nice offshoots of writing books, is developing areas of interest that I can continue to pursue even once the book is over. Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, there's another category of interests that I develop in order to write a book. And then when I've written the book, I'm not interested anymore. It's so weird. It's like, yeah. I just use it up. Right. I mean, I still, for example, play tennis. I'm really a tawdry player, but with great passion. But once I wrote my sixth novel, Double Fault, which mm-hmm. was about two professional tennis players who get married and then end up suffering from being horribly competitive with each other. Once the book was over, I stopped watching professional tennis on TV going to matches. It was like, I'd used that. I was probably not going to return to it. And I was just back to being an amateur who barely kept up with what was happening on the circuit. And the same thing happened with the post-birthday world. I got very involved in the world of snooker, of all things, since one of my main characters was a snooker player. And I went to matches and I watched them on TV incessantly. I had been watching snooker as a weird sideline for some years, which is why I came to write that character. But once again, the book came out, I stopped watching snooker cold. I was not going to write another snooker player probably again in my life. And I had burnt that interest out. So I can never predict whether something is going to be an ongoing fascination or something that I have simply mercilessly used and then thrown away.
Right. Well, that sort of scratches at one of my curiosities, which is, you know, you changed your name early, I think kind of early in life.
I was 15.
15, yeah. You moved from the US to the UK at some point and also spent some time in Ireland. And I was wondering if experimenting, trying on, inhabiting different identities or, you know, personas, how that plays with your novel writing. Do you feel like that's sort of an essential component in dialogue with your work, or do you feel like that's completely kind of separate from the work you do? Does that make sense?
Do you mean in terms of where I live?
No, I mean more in terms of, is the act of trying on different cultures, different, maybe, you know, stronger gender roles, any of that aiding of you in inhabiting different points of view in fiction? Does the artistic world mirror the personal world, or are those two worlds completely not in conversation with each other?
Well, it certainly helped me in terms of being able to set books outside the United States. You know, I like to set books in places that I'm familiar with and I feel authoritative about. So yes, that's made a difference. It's actually made it harder, however, to set books in the United States. I spend three quarters of the year in the UK. And, you know, on the one hand, obviously, I've kept my accent. But on the other, the way people speak around me is in British parlance, you know, British slang. And at the same time, how people talk in the United States continues to change. I mean, I try to keep up because I do go back every summer. But I get less conversant in Americanese, if you will, and it becomes a little harder to write the dialogue. And by the way, I want to head off any impression that I think that makes me somehow superior because, oh, I've become so British. it's not like that. It's not an advantage at all. I like to consider myself bilingual, you know. I speak American and I speak British, but it's nothing to brag about if you're bilingual and you're losing one of your languages. It is really important for me to go back to the United States in order to keep up some modicum of that fluency. But meantime, you know, I'm not necessarily watching the same television shows you are. It's a little complicated, but in general, I think it's an advantage. I mean, I like to regard myself as having enlarged my world by having left the United States and still keeping the United States within my orbit. Otherwise, it would just be a trade-off, and I sacrifice the United States of a familiarity with someone somewhere else, and that's not enlarging. But I do think it's been useful to me as a writer and as an intellect to live somewhere else. And I think it's especially useful for Americans, because if we have a weakness as a people, you know, it's a big country, it has plenty of variation within it, and it can come to seem like the whole world.
It's amazing how few U.S. citizens have passport. Yeah, we are people who are happy to stay at home and happy to believe that that is enough. So that is, it's interesting.
Well, you've had copious opportunity in the last year to stay
right, to stay at home. Yes. So that is a nice segue, I think, to talk about this book. I'm going to let you introduce it. You'll do a better job. I kind of did a little inadequate job at the beginning, but take us into Kay and Cyril's world here and set the stage, and we will jump off and dive in.
Sure. Well, I didn't think that your summary was at all inadequate, but yes, the couple at issue both work for the National Health Service. The wife is a nurse and he's a general practitioner. And they have seen a lot of patients age and decay, as well as having to suffer through the wife Kay's father's horrifying and depersonalizing dementia. So they resolve in their early 50s that it looked to them as if once you reach about the age of 80, life is all downhill. And it, both in terms of, well, to spare the National Health Service the cost of their decay, and also to spare each other and their loved ones the degradation of who they had always been, that they would just hit the exit on Kay's 80th birthday. And the book just fast forwards immediately. It's like you turn the page and you're coming up on Kay's 80th birthday. So, and it's a parallel universe book. So the question, of course, is once they are on that birthday, do they do it or not? And if they don't do it, what happens? I developed 12 different scenarios, a couple of which veer into speculative fiction. I mean, it's a very playful book. It has a it has obviously a morbid premise, but in order in some ways to offset that premise, it's done with a very light heart. You know, in one of them goes ahead with it and the other doesn't, or there's one in which, you know, they're not in that bad a shape once they reach her birthday. And so Kay just says, you know, this is ridiculous. We're not going to do this. Forget it.
Forget it.
Let's do the dishes. And, you know, there's another one in which there's a cure, you know, they don't do it. There's a cure for aging and they live forever.
Yeah, so it's a really fun mix of, as you say, sci-fi, dystopia. There's one little scene of horror. So you get, yeah, it reminded me of those Choose Your Own Adventure books that I read when I was a kid. You know, they were so popular in the 70s. And you get to choose all the adventures. You get to see how these things play out in all sorts of different scenarios. So that was fun.
Yes, it's definitely a book that doesn't give you any answers.
Right.
And that's, again, one of the thrills of fiction. What puts me off the idea of writing nonfiction books is having answers. You're expected to have answers. And I'm much better at the questions. And the questions are much more fun. Yeah. And, you know, there is a certain method to the madness in the book, because you're looking at, well, okay, you're facing this decision. If you go through with it, what wonderful things might you miss out on? But it's also asking, okay, but what horrible things might you get out of?
Right.
And I'm, by the way, as a writer, I'm much better at the horrible things.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's, for that, for example, there's a one chapter where they live past 100, but in the meantime, Western civilization collapses, and it's horrific. And it's that chapter specifically asks the question, you know, another question. Okay, let's say that Western civilization is going to collapse, you know, anarchists burn down parliament. Do you want to see it or not? If it's going to happen anyway, do you want to be around to observe it out of sheer curiosity, or would you rather not know? And I can't answer that question for myself, honestly.
Yep. Yep.
Because I am very curious, and I am, you know, a newspaper reader, and I am following many different stories that aren't just stories. They're what is actually happening. And I am curious how they end or evolve, since they never end really. But there are some things that I'm not sure I want to see. So I don't know. So the way that chapter resolves or fail to, the wife says, you know, looking back, I'd rather not have gone through this. I'd rather not know. I now look back and wish we had gone through with it when I was 80, when everything was still fine. And the husband differs and says, well, if this is going to happen anyway, you know, honestly, I'd rather have lived to see it. You know, I have that much curiosity. I want to take this in.
There's some line when they are going to go forward with it. And she said, you know, it feels as though I have to return all these unread library books to the library. And I thought that was such a perfect metaphor. Exactly. That is what it would feel like. And I had that same thought throughout the pandemic on this side of the pond when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away right before the election. I was like, but you'll never know. Now you won't find out.
In fact, in the novel, one of the things that Kay points out is that, well, if we go through with this, now we'll never know whether Donald Trump was reelected.
Yeah, no, that thought occurred to me so many times in real life during the, as people were passing away, I'm like, now you won't find out the ending to this very exciting novel we're all living through. Do you feel like this is a book you could have, I mean, obviously the pandemic is current, but do you feel like this is a book you could or would have written 20 years ago, meaning, do you feel like this book was pandemic driven, or do you feel like this book was your own age and interest in aging, mortality, end of life issues driven?
Oh, unquestionably the latter.
Okay.
I started this book pre-pandemic.
Ah,
I started it on what the British call Boxing Day of 2019. And in fact, I know that your audience is interested in writing process, and I'm generally not. But this little process bit interested me. I needed to choose Kay's birthday, because this was, of course, the pivotal date in the book from which everything would shoot off. And I also wanted to publish in contemporaneous a manner as possible. So, because, you know, it takes about a year to bring a book to market. So I thought I'd push the date out a little bit. And I chose the end of March 2020. So that was about 3 months into the future. And I told myself, what's going to happen in 3 months? Yeah.
Right.
Well, and what happened is that I was writing away. I wrote this book very quickly. And then I had my eye on that date. And then we got to March and everything started going to hell. And I realized that, uh-oh.
Damn. Yeah.
You know, I had the option of moving the date, of course. I could have just changed it to February. And then I wouldn't have had to deal with the pandemic. But it first of all, it seemed as if this was going to turn out to be a rather large historical event. And in order to be, if I put the book on the far side of that so that it didn't acknowledge the pandemic, it would date the book in a bad way.
Correct.
So if I wanted that contemporaneous thing, then I had to involve the pandemic. And furthermore, it was more material, you know, it was more stuff. It was another issue I could use with my couple. And it ended up being, you know, as we coined earlier in this interview, artistically profitable.
Yes.
Right? It was great material. They come up on this pivotal date in their personal lives. And then suddenly everyone's dying all around them. And it looks to them as if nobody's going to notice if they kill themselves, right? It's just another couple elderly people who've kicked the bucket. They would go completely unnoticed. And Kay especially feels bewildered and outclassed.
Well, I mean, it would have been an utterly different novel if the pandemic was not the backdrop. And the pandemic really accelerated all of these conversations about the worth and value of our elderly, and conversations about age, and conversations about economics surrounding age. What do we defer and put off as a collective to protect this? At the time, we thought these are the only people that are dying of this. So, I mean, the conversation would have been utterly changed had the pandemic not been the backdrop. The interesting part of that is that I have a lot of conversations with authors where I ask, is this a topic you will ever touch? And almost universally so far, the answer is no. I'm never writing about the pandemic. I want to leave this behind. If I write about it, it'll be 20 years from now. So when I picked this up and I was like, damn, she hit this head on right now. As you say, it takes a year to get a novel out. So you were writing this very contemporaneously with events as they were unfolding. And it's both an act of bravery, I think, because you don't know what the future holds day to day back then or now, but also, you know, just to get the clarity and perspective of how to write about something as it's unfolding around you, I think would be difficult.
Well, it was important to me that I was not writing a pandemic novel. The COVID-19 plays a modest part in this book.
Yeah.
And that's partly because I had a feeling that, I mean, you say that all the people you talk to don't want to write about it, but I think there's going to be another cadre that did write about it. I
Yeah.
think that we are going to be hit by a slew of lockdown novels. And this is not a lockdown novel. And I have a funny feeling that most people are not going to want to read them because we're just going to want to put it behind us.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, for example, immediately after the end of the Vietnam War, nobody wanted to read books about Vietnam or even watch movies about Vietnam. It's like, we're out of there, get it out of my face. You know, that's, I went through that. I want something different. So I just use the pandemic as something else that the couple can talk about. And also I've kind of lucked out because the form that I had chosen meant that anything that happens, because it's a parallel universe, anything that happens after that date in March is up to me. So I was not held hostage by reality. So I have one chapter in which the economic damage ended up, because of all the lockdowns, ended up being so severe that despite all the money that the governments pump into the economy, as Biden, it turns out, is doing now, it doesn't work. Inflation takes off. And people who had any assets, like my couple, lose everything. They're heading into a permanent recession or depression. But there's another chapter in which there's an immediate recovery and everyone bounces back and thrives and businesses take off and everything is wonderful. But because of the form I was working in, both those things can be true.
So, another process question. Did you sort of make a list at the front end? Here are all the permutations that I'm going to deal with, or did writing one chapter beget another chapter?
Oh, I'm a planner.
Okay.
So I knew I wanted to write this book. I had it churning in the back of my head for a while. And I just, before I got going, I sat down and laid out every idea I had. And
Okay.
interestingly, when I was doing that, I was giving myself permission to write down anything I thought of, whatever. You know, I could always change my mind or delete one or take it in a different direction. But as it turned out, although I collapsed a couple of ideas together, I ended up following that outline to the letter and even in the same order that I wrote them.
Really?
Yeah, it was surprising. And I laid that list out in about 2 hours.
My guest this morning is Lionel Shriver. The book we're talking about is Should We Stay or Should We Go? You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You know, the one interesting thing to me, and I say this as an atheist on a most day and an agnostic on a good day, is it didn't have a lot of spirituality and religion in it playing into their decision to end their lives. That kind of conversation didn't really come up. And I was wondering if that was intentional, you don't want to go there, or if it's just not interesting to you.
It's a little alien to me, which is perhaps odd for me to say, because I did grow up in a professionally Christian family.
Right.
But I've never quite known what people mean by spiritual. I've certainly used the word, but it eludes me. Mm-hmm. And I don't entirely understand belief in God or the embrace of religion. I don't get it. I grew up around it, but I didn't understand it then. I still don't. And I have reflected on this before, that if there's a real hole in my fiction in terms of the kind of characters that I write, people who are religious are almost missing or treated very badly, right? Mm-hmm. So in my last book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, there's a daughter in the novel who has become a born-again Christian. And, you know, she's portrayed as not exactly just an idiot, but as someone who is using this newfound faith as a weapon against her parents.
Right.
Right. So, and I guess I'll give myself credit in so much for that. There is a minister, I think he's Methodist, and he's a sympathetic character. And yeah, that's as far as I've gone.
Right.
But by and large, the world of religion is almost inaccessible to me. And because I grew up hostile to religion, I tend to steer clear of it most of the time, because I don't see that there's any point in writing about something like that if you're not able to be somewhat sympathetic with it, and if you're not able to inhabit it.
Right, because it wouldn't give it the authenticity.
It wouldn't be fair.
Sort of depth,
it wouldn't be good. It wouldn't be authentic or genuine. There would be no point in pretending to inhabit it only to make fun of it.
And yet the subject matter lends itself to all sorts of unexpected philosophical conversations about deception and marital obligation and parental obligation and economics and morality and all of these things. I mean, leaving spirituality off the table didn't diminish how many other topics there were to cover in this. So the only reason I thought of it was, you know, there's such a clamoring in the Western world about religion and its intersection with issues of end of life and preservation of life. So yeah, that's interesting. This is sort of a process and philosophical question, I guess, at the same time, but it's interesting to think about, are we who we are in alternate universes? You know, the essential self is the self that made this very consequential decision. And it's not a decision like, am I going to wear a red blouse or a blue blouse? This is, you know, am I going to end a life? Am I going to ask a spouse who may also be very healthy to make this decision with me? Are we going to keep this from our children, depriving them of the ability to say goodbye to us? All of these big questions. And so as these characters move through that decision in different ways, did you think about them as different people? Because a wholly different person would make a wholly different decision. So did you have to kind of reinvent them each time and change the way you thought about them in each chapter?
No, I didn't. I think that the characters remain pretty constant, but character isn't a straitjacket. So the same person can make a different decision almost whimsically or arbitrarily, depending on the day or their state of mind. In each of the chapters, different aspects of their character become dominant. There's no question that the husband, Cyril, is portrayed as the ideologue of the two. And he is consistently an ideologue, although that's a way of being that is subject to change. So that in the eternal life chapter, he becomes much more philosophical and open-minded. It's not a contradiction of who he is. It's an evolution. And I mean, that's one of the things that fiction writers have to deal with all the time, is how much you allow your characters to transform while still being credibly the same person and recognizable to the reader. But of course, some of the best fiction out there has characters transforming fantastically. I think one of the reasons that Breaking Bad is so popular and so artistically successful is that it allows its characters to morph. And by the end of that series, Walter White is a completely different person.
Absolutely. Right.
That's one of the things that made that series more novelistic and less like traditional television. Traditional television as a form has tended to pull character back to the very beginning, you know, so that the beginning of every episode, you're the same person that you were in the first episode.
Right.
One of the things that has changed about television is that those rules have been lifted and characters are allowed to develop, and they don't, you don't anymore have, you know, something big happen in a series that has no consequences.
Were there universes in which either Kay or Cyril's character was a little confounding to you, that their decision-making felt something at odds with what had come before that you had to grapple with?
Well, again, I come back to this Eternal Life chapter, which is where my characters become less and less recognizable in some ways. But you follow that journey, and I think it works.
Yeah.
What happened with Kay is, you know, she's been the more passionate one. You can tell that she has more attachments to other people. She's more grounded, and she becomes much more lost and cynical in a way that you wouldn't ever expect. There's another chapter in which they become cryogenically preserved, and they wake up hundreds of years later with the human race having evolved in ways that they hardly recognize. Everyone's over 8 feet tall.
And the collective Borg, yeah.
Yeah, that chapter is called Love Doesn't Freeze. And one thing that has kept constant throughout the novel is the marriage, all right? Mm-hmm. It's not a perfect marriage, and they certainly have a lot of difficulties with their grown children, but there is a constancy to their feeling for each other and their loyalty to each other. And right. In Love Doesn't Freeze, that breaks, because right. When they are reanimated, the biggest thing that has changed is that they have no feeling for one another. And it's actually the most heartbreaking chapter in the whole book. It's a kind of horror story. And so that earlier in the book, there's a long and for me anyway, touching passage when Cyril, who doesn't tend to confess to being very emotional, confides that the one thing that he finds it hardest to say goodbye to about all of life is the experience of sleeping with his wife. Not having sex, sleeping with his wife. And they've always had a perfect fit in bed. And there's just this, it's a long description of the sumptuousness of achieving different positions, and they are all perfectly comfortable. But in the Love Doesn't Freeze chapter, they finally lie down in the same bed and try to sleep, and everything's uncomfortable and awkward and unpleasant. And it's horrible. It's horrible. And I think that it's actually a relief to turn the page and get on to the next chapter, and they're fine again.
There were a lot of chapters where it was a relief to turn the page.
Yes.
That was an enduring theme, I will say. Is the one thing the book accomplished, well, the book accomplished a lot, but one was, you know, it made you less afraid of death when you really have to play out all the permutations of what immortality might mean or what, you know, eternal life might mean. It's horrifying. It really is horrifying. So somebody just recently asked George Saunders, you know, his opinion on death, and he said, I'm against it. And I'm like, maybe I'm not that against it. Maybe I'm actually for it. So,
well, it was
yeah,
interesting there's... thinking about what it would be like to live forever. And it turns out to little by little to evolve into a complete nightmare. In that chapter, Cyril ends up becoming a therapist, which he would never have qualified for in the beginning of the book. And his patients are tormented by suicidal ideation, yet they almost never act on it.
No, you can see it. There's a really, going back to the cryogenics chapter, there's just this wonderful metaphor about freezing a piece of meat, and that, you know, when you take it out of the freezer after 10 years, yes, it's still meat in there somewhere, but it is not the same meat. And
It's lost its flavor.
It has lost something very essential to the meatness of the meat. To that end, I was wondering, do you see any obligation of the fiction writer, not the nonfiction writer, but the fiction writer as seer or ethicist or commentator or sounder of alarms? Or do you just see yourself, do you just see the job as entertainment sounds like too vapid, but kind of what is the job of the fiction writer, you know, beyond engaging the reader in an entertaining ride?
I think it's important to carve out for any fiction writer the right to define his or her job as he or she likes. You know, there are no obligations on a fiction writer. There is no particular agenda you have to meet. You set your own agenda. That is one of the great things about the occupation. It's also one of the terrible things about the occupation. It's a pretty big responsibility to have to set your own parameters and your own purpose. So while I have written a lot of books that speak to contemporary issues, there is no obligation to do so.
Yeah.
You know, that's my decision. And, you know, you said you apologized for using the word entertainment, but I wouldn't. In terms of what the obligations are, that's in some ways the sole obligation is to be entertaining. Although I use that word loosely, because there are different ways to be entertained. Even being tormented on the page is a kind of entertainment.
Right.
And intellectual engagement is also a form of entertainment. But most of all, fiction has to, you know, you have to give your reader something. And it is a luxury. It's a pleasure. It's not supposed to be, it shouldn't be your homework. In fact, one of the things that I, as a kid and as an adolescent, I really hated being given assignments to read novels. I considered them fun, and I hated being told I had to read it, which changed the experience. I think fiction should feel like an indulgence. And so, yes, and that's your only obligation, is to somehow make the time that your reader has spent with your book better than they might have spent it doing something else. It's primitive, but it's also really hard because there are a lot of other things to do.
So for yourself, you would define your own, I shouldn't come back to the word obligation, but your own role as fiction writer, first as entertainer and then as, what would you say?
It's my job to think for you. Or to think with you, which is a much better way to put it. Mm-hmm. It's my job to think with you. I find one of the most satisfying things about writing is getting down on paper, or that metaphor doesn't work anymore. It's getting on the screen, something that feels true, all right? And getting it to the best of my ability into words. What I'm generally delivering in that instant is not something that nobody's ever thought before. It's not that I'm some seer who has discovered an amazing revelation, but it's much more likely that I have simply managed to encapsulate what everyone else would also recognize as true. And that's what people respond to more than anything, rather than something foreign or exotic that is unfamiliar to them. It's more the recognition of what is sometimes foreign and exotic within the familiar, that you crystallize something. And by the way, this is an identical pleasure in reading for me. You know, when I come across a passage which crystallizes something that I have experienced or thought, but maybe not in so many words, something that resonates with me. And it is a kind of sharing with the author, that realization, that reality, that moment of making the intangible tangible in some way.
Right. And
words seem to create a tangibility. I love plot. I love moving things along. I love conversation. But some of my favorite parts of my own novels and other people's novels are those often reasonably short passages that are pausing for reflection or trying to get some idea into words. And I think that's what fiction in particular has to offer over against other art forms like film and TV. You know,
right.
We're not going to have a word from our sponsor where someone reads you a page. It's just not going to happen.
Hopefully, so yeah.
The kind of reflection that is exclusive, especially to the novel.
Interiority.
Yes.
Access to the interiority.
Right. Or it doesn't even have to be interiority so much as, you know, it can also just be turning a lens out on the world. I mean, one of my favorite passages in So Much for That, I now realize it's going to make me sound like I'm obsessed with suicide, but they, maybe I am. One of my main characters is walking home and he is on the way to kill himself. And he is reflecting on everything that he is glad to see the back of. And it's actually just a list and it goes on for a couple of pages. But it's one of those, it took me days to put that list together. And it's full of kind of arbitrary, weird little like packaging that you can't get into without pruning shears. You know, it's just right. little things. And now that's what I mean. It is not exactly a reflection. It is in putting the lens on the outside world.
Yeah.
But it gets you down actually to an interior state because he's ready. He's had enough.
Right. It's how it reflects on his mental, the exterior world reflecting on the
on the interior. Yeah.
Right. On the mental state. Right. It's interesting going back to my very original observation of being obsessed with death and aging. And I've become addicted to this brand new podcast called 70 over 70, where
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, it's brand new, but he's interviewing 70 people over the age of 70 about their experiences of aging and death, their relationship now with their own mortality. And he takes like Sister Helen, who guides the prisoners through their execution here in the U.S. She wrote Dead Man Walking. Just very interesting perspectives on death and dying. And one of the subjects is an actor, theater actor. And he said, audiences always come to the theater. The theater is our most authentic self, which I think fiction also calls us to be our most authentic self, more authentic than we are just in everyday living, and, you know, forces us, the audience comes asking a question that they want answered. And I thought that was a little bit true of fiction too, that we come to a book, maybe we don't articulate it that way, that we want an answer to a question, but it is what we want. And maybe that's all a different way of saying what you had just much more articulately said,
I mean, I said that I'm better at asking questions than answers. There's a way in which fiction will often throw the duty to find an answer back on the reader.
Right.
I can't count the number of times I've been asked about, we need to talk about Kevin, which poses the question, you know, if this kid killed several of his classmates, is it his fault? Was he born evil? Or is it the fault of his mother who didn't love him enough?
Right.
Now, the book absolutely, militantly refuses to answer that question. And it infuriates readers at events because they will sometimes have waited for months or years to ask the author what the real answer is. And I refuse right. to give it to them. But the point is that it's the reader. I've given you this story. You've got the stuff. You've got the evidence. It's up to you. You're in the jury. You're a jury of one. It's up to you.
Right.
You come up with the verdict.
And isn't that how life is?
I mean,
you know, it's eternal unanswered questions down the, you know, turtles all the way down. There's no answers to a lot of these questions. So that's the experience of life, which I think is what's so satisfying about literary fiction as opposed to genre fiction. But
the experience of asking them and probing them and exploring different aspects of, well, you know, what about this and what about that? I mean, it's fascinating. And that is life. That is life. That is really interesting. And the truth is that I don't know about you. I can't, but I'll speak for myself. As interested as I am in aging and mortality, I hardly ever sit down socially and just talk about aging and death. I don't.
You lose friends that way, really.
It's not just not a subject we talk about very much.
It's not polite.
And yet it is fascinating.
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, if you want to make people squirm, you bring this up at a dinner conversation and you're right, you clear the room. But what is more important than having those conversations? I mean, I think it's so essential. It's the most essential thing about being human. So fiction is where we can go to kind of have that conversation and play the thread all the way out.
Yeah.
And it's probably unfair of me to ask then if the book changed your mind about anything. if the act of writing it and going down all of these rabbit holes changed your perspective?
I think it sobered me, and specifically about myself, in that before I started it, I would have been fairly sure that there are degrees of decay that I simply wouldn't put up with. And given the opportunity to exercise agency, I would refuse to degenerate beyond a certain point. That is, I would kill myself.
Yeah.
And when I finished the book, I realized I'm not so sure, because it helped me appreciate the starkness of the choice. I mean, you're choosing between something and nothing. It doesn't seem like much of a choice. In fact, there's a passage in the novel where Kay points out, you know, look, you know, look at it as you would a gambler. You know, you can either lose your whole stake or maybe win something.
Right.
So I guess I started realizing that I'm probably not any different than other people. And most of us are willing to put up with absolutely anything rather than die.
Yeah.
Anything.
The body wants to live. Yeah, regardless of what the mind wants, you know, the body wants to live,
and the body is in control.
Right.
The body will keep living. Right. Whatever happens to you inside, it wants to stick around. And that, you know, that whole business of whatever you want to call it, life force or survival instinct or something, there's nothing more profound. And to imagine that you are bigger than it or, you know, somehow an exception to that rule is arrogant in the extreme.
False. Yes. Right.
So, you know, most people do imagine, whether they articulate it or not, you know, they look at all those people that we've seen broadcast, you know, during the pandemic in care homes. And we think, you know, that's never going to be me. They are never going to put me in one of those places. You know, most of us end up in one of those places.
Yeah.
We think we're not going to, but we're going to.
My grandfather was of the opinion that, well, this was several years back. So 70 was his age, you know, that everybody on your 70th birthday, they round you up and there's a firing squad and that's how it works. And then he turned 70 and then it was 75 and then it was 80 and, you know, he finally died at 82, but he had that opinion all the way through until he turned the age, and then he changed his opinion. Yeah.
Well, I tell you, I on the other hand, I have a friend whose husband, whom I really liked him. He was a wonderful guy, funny and warm. I love that combination. And he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's last year at the age of 67. Mm. He'd played a lot of American football. And within a handful of months, he went to Dignitas and quit. Mm. That's really hard to do, you know, and I admire it. There's a purity to it and there's a generosity to it. And also an informed self-interest. He did not want to become demented. He did not want to subject his wife to a shell of his former self. And he simply rejected that future. He was not going to do that to others. He did not want to go through it. And he was going to take a clean exit. You know, there's a certain kind of person who can do that. And most of us are not that kind of person.
It's a selfless act in a lot of ways. Wow.
And the trouble is that when you say that, then it seems to impugn people who don't do it and stick around anyway in whatever condition. And it seems as if you're saying, well, you're selfish and you shouldn't be here anymore. And I certainly wouldn't want to take responsibility for that position.
Well, you play that out in the book as well.
No, I think I covered a
covered
lot of
it
the
all.
Angles.
Yeah.
I may have missed out on the spiritual card, but I played all the other ones.
You definitely did. And no worse the wear for the spiritual for me, but I had to ask the question. So this was such a great talk. I can't tell you how much fun I had. Are there things we should have mentioned or advice that you'd like to leave or something we didn't say that you'd love to end on?
Well, I just know that a lot of your audience are fiction writers. I would just encourage writers, published or unpublished, I don't care. I think we just need to be a little braver and more relaxed and have more of a sense of humor and confidence in our own perspectives and our own projects. I'm afraid that we are living in a cautious, fearful time. And I'm not talking about the pandemic, when we're worried that we're going to break some rule or step on somebody's toes. And I just think we all need to get past that. That way lies crummy books. You know, cautious books are crummy books. Don't be so careful. Take some risks.
Great advice. And you're a great example of somebody who, and I meant to ask you this earlier, if publishing is an importance to you, meaning, are you a believer in writing for writer's sake versus having, you know, an audience to consume it? Because you wrote for a lot of years, published many novels until Kevin was kind of the breakout in 2003. Is it important? Like, do you feel like it's important to have a big platform, or do you feel like the writing itself is what's really more important?
I don't think you need to set those two things against each other. People vary a lot as to whether they actively enjoy the writing itself. And I know that there's some people who find it rather unpleasant. I happen to be fortunate in that as long as the book is working, which it isn't always, then I'm pretty happy. I'm generally enjoying myself. I love making myself laugh. But I think sometimes that we expect too much of aspirant writers, that is, people who have made an effort over and over again, maybe even written multiple books, or at least multiple short stories, but often multiple books. And they're just supposed to keep on going for the joy of creation. And I think that is unreasonable. Had I not had a book take off, and I was having a really hard time getting published by that point, certainly in the United States. I was still publishing in the UK, but it wasn't, not making any money. And selling very few copies, more importantly. You know, I'm not sure that I could have kept churning out unpublished novels indefinitely. It's depressing. You know, it is an act of communication, and you need to be heard. And if you're not being heard, it starts to feel pointless. And I'm very sympathetic with writers right now in particular, because I think it's harder than ever to get published. You can always self-publish, and there are success stories in there, but they're rare. And for the most part, self-publication dooms you to a very small audience. And an audience is part of the experience. You know, I may not talk to very many of the people who read my books, but I know that I have not, there is an audience. And therefore, the effort that I spent on a book was not entirely pointless. So an audience is a vital part of the experience of being a writer. It closes the circle. It gives you purpose.
Well, and going back to your earlier point, that is the beauty of fiction, is the conversation with the reader, right? So if you're lacking that, you're right. You're lacking the essential other end of the conversation, to melding of minds, a meeting of minds. Yeah.
I would actually say that you don't need to hear back from them.
No, right. I didn't. Right. Yes.
Yeah. You just know they're out there somewhere, and the book was therefore not a complete waste of time.
Correct. The tree falling in the woods is still making the noise. Yes, right. Right. Lionel Shriver, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Oh, thank you for talking to me at such length. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. That was Lionel Shriver. The book, Should We Stay or Should We Go, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.